This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
Islam is not about converting culture. It's about converting faith and spirituality and understanding. And I can still be American through and through, even if I'm wearing a headscarf and even if I'm dressing in what might appear to be something foreign.
Karen Danielson converted to Islam 3 decades ago when she was just 19 years old. Her experience is not as unusual as it may seem. Some 20% of American Muslims are converts, and they've come into the public eye recently. 2 weeks ago, a Michigan woman and a Muslim convert was killed in fighting in Syria, and the alleged mastermind of the Boston Marathon bombing, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was married to a Muslim convert. Leaving one religion for another can be a complicated process for anyone. But in the United States, converting to Islam can mean making some especially difficult personal choices, at least for some people. And that was the case for Karen Danielson. She was raised Catholic and then later became a Baptist and enrolled in a Baptist college where she picked up the Quran. Karen Danielson is our Sunday conversation.
I had taken a Quran with me because I had chosen my missions to be the Middle East. And I was planning on going to the Arab world.
As a Christian missionary.
As a Christian missionary. And during my free time at the college, my first year, I began reading the Quran. And it struck many chords in my heart. And so I became a Muslim.
When you discovered the Quran and you found inspiration in that book, you could have taken that and left it at that, left it as perhaps a dimension of your own spirituality. Why did you decide you wanted to convert and live a life as a Muslim, which would require changes to how you lived, changes to your culture that you had grown up with?
What made me believe is that I had a prayer. I sat in my dorm by myself and I kneeled on the ground and I picked up the Quran and I said, God, if this is what you want me to follow, it better be easy for me. You know, I can't have any doubt. And I put my head down in prayer and I began crying and I lifted my head up and I felt calm and at peace and cool, and that was my sign. So, and I just moved forward knowing that the Quran was going to be my guide.
What was your family's reaction when you did tell them?
I think the biggest problem was with them didn't really occur until they saw me dressing with the hijab on.
This is the headscarf that Muslims use to cover their heads.
Right. This is when they got very concerned. And when I introduced them to my husband, who is Palestinian, again, they were more concerned. Even at one point, my mom had kicked me out and said, don't ever come back to this home again dressed that way. I never want to see you like this. But I kept calling her, and I did that because I discovered in Islam that the duty to parents is very important. And then eventually, as the birth of my first son took place, my mom opened up, came into our home.
What were the public perceptions to how you were then living your life? I mean, you had friends, I imagine, a community, and one day you are Karen Danielson, a wayward Catholic who does not wear a headscarf. And then, you know, another day you are a devout Muslim woman who wears hijab.
It was a really difficult time. My closest friend, she tolerated me up until my wedding day and then just didn't show up for my wedding day, which was, you know, a big blow because none of my family members showed up either. So I kept looking at the door, is somebody coming? And nobody came. That was a difficult thing.
What about public reactions? Did people treat you differently?
I had the gamut of reactions, depending on what was in the news, I guess you could say. So in the 80s, it was like, what are you wearing, you know, and aren't you hot in that? And, you know, you're an American now. You don't have to dress like that anymore. To go home, you sand N-word. Mm-hmm. 9 out of 10 times I can contain myself, but that 10th time I had to turn around and respond like, where do you want me to go? This is my home. Mm-hmm. There were some scary times as well. I remember after 9/11, I'm from the Bridgeview community here in Chicago in the southwest suburbs. We were under attack. There was a mob forming outside our neighborhood, outside the mosque neighborhood, and the police asked us to stay in our homes, and we couldn't leave because they were marching at the at our. It was a difficult time. But I did receive some of the most beautiful phone calls. We know you can't go out. Can we go and buy you a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk? Or what does your family need? Mm-hmm. A woman drove up into my driveway and opened her trunk, and I, total stranger, and her trunk was full of flowers, and she's like, I just want to deliver these flowers to Muslim homes. Could you point some out for me? She gave me a small pallet of flowers, and that was amazing, you know, and that shows how beautiful America actually is.
Mm-hmm.
It was what sustained us through those times, knowing that there were people who did not hate us.
Obviously, after the Boston bombings, it emerged that the older of the Tsarnaev brothers, Tamerlan, had married a white Christian woman who then converted to Islam for him. What was your response when you first heard that? Do you just zone out these news headlines?
I just felt totally sorry for this woman because I knew the media was going to have a field day with her, and they did. And it was really sad. And I just pray that God, you know, keeps her patient and strong. I purposely did not follow every news clipping about her. I don't like the stereotype. I don't like to be grouped in that stereotype. I've had people come up to me, say things to me like, you're not supposed to be driving a car. What are you driving a car for? Your religion forbids you to drive a car. And I'm like, what? You don't know what you're talking about. That's the furthest thing from the truth. You don't have any clue. And I have met women who weren't Muslim and they've married a Muslim man and they've ended up converting, but it's a rare bird who just does it for her husband's sake.
We talked a little about the resistance that your immediate family and your friends had when you converted. I wonder what the response was from the Muslim community.
They look at American converts as something quite utopian-like and amazing. You know, oh my God, you accepted this religion coming from such a distant cultural background. And so that's why I think converts tend to form support groups, because we really need each other. And so we have to support each other and direct Islam to become part and parcel of the American scene, not just this foreign element in America.
What's your relationship like now with your family?
Both my parents have passed. My father passed over 10 years ago, and he was quite proud of me. And my mother as well was very proud to have me as her daughter and would ask me to read Quran to her and pray for her when she was going through her illness. In regard to my brother and my sister, I have a somewhat cordial relationship with my brother and a very distant relationship with my sister. But there's still hope.
Karen Danielson, she converted to Islam 30 years ago. Karen, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
A classic theater in Detroit is getting a new lease on life, courtesy of Jack White. It seems that the Detroit Masonic Temple is home to an iconic music venue, the Cathedral Theater, and the temple owed some $142,000 in back taxes. But along came an anonymous donor who paid the tab. This week, the Masons revealed that the benefactor was none other than the famous rock musician. According to the Guardian newspaper, Jack White has performed at the temple 9 times. And over the decades, the place has also attracted acts like The Who, Jimi Hendrix, The Rolling Stones, and Frank Zappa. In expressing their gratitude, the Detroit Masons have announced that the Cathedral Theater will henceforth be known as the Jack White Theater. I guess if you're a Mason, you gotta love rock. Get it? Mason. Rock.
I'm the seventh son.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. 1001 Nights is one of the most enchanting works of world literature. It begins with a king who discovers that his wife is having an affair. In a fit of rage, he has her executed.
And from that night, he decreed a law that he will marry a virgin every single day, deflower her at night, and then kill her at dawn.
This killing continues until Scheherazade, the daughter of the king's closest advisor, offers herself as the king's bride.
She had a plan, a very eloquent and very civilized plan. She wanted to use her art to humanize him and to stop this bloodbath.
That's Lebanese author Hanan al-Sheikh, and she's published a modern adaptation of 1001 Nights.
She started to tell him every day a story. She will stop at a very crucial moment in the story. And then she will tell him, well, now it's dawn and I cannot go on telling. It's the time for you to kill me.
Night after night, the king is enraptured by Scheherazade's storytelling, tales of mystery, romance, magic, and deception, until finally the king, now a wiser and kinder man, spares her life, and the women of the kingdom are saved.
I think she was the first feminist on earth.
Scheherazade and her stories have become a touchstone of Arab culture, part of an oral tradition that goes back centuries, put to paper in countless editions, even serialized for the radio. And that is where author al-Sheikh first heard them as a child.
And I was smitten. But at the same time, I was exasperated because I really wanted her to poison him and finish with that.
You write in your prologue that you wanted desperately to escape the world that this book evoked. Why was that, and what brought you back to this story?
Well, I grew up in Beirut, Lebanon, and all the characters around me, especially women, were very crafty and very intelligent, and they had a way to deal with life. And I thought they are more or less like Scheherazade, while I wanted to become an existentialist like Simone de Beauvoir or Françoise Sagan. And I wanted to be somewhere else than my neighborhood. I thought I was more modern than everyone around me.
All these years later, what pulled you back?
The West. When I started publishing, every single review, they would call me the new Scheherazade, the new Scheherazade. And I used to think, oh, it is a cliche. Why do they do that? I don't like Scheherazade. But then I thought, I want to read 1001 Night and see why am I called Scheherazade. And then one director, he asked me if I'm willing to adapt stories from 1001 Night for the theater. And of course, this is when I sat and read 6,000 pages. Oh. I read 3 editions in Arabic.
How did you choose the tales that you did? Because as you mentioned, it's the original work is 2,000 pages.
Yes.
So you had to do some curating. How did you decide what to include in your version?
It was so difficult because every time I read a story, I said, that's it. I'm in love with the story. And then I felt that I was plunging in a sea of jewels and I couldn't really choose very easily. And then the director and I thought that we should find a theme, a plot. And of course, from all these stories, the theme was the women are wily and men were oppressive in a way. So we thought it should be a war between the two sexes. Yes. And I chose stories where women dependent completely on being crafty and manipulative in order to survive.
How were these tales received? I mean, was Scheherazade regaled as a heroine?
No, not at all. All of us, especially Arab women, educated Arab women, would say, no, do you think I am Scheherazade? A slave sitting and telling you stories so you won't kill me? This is how we thought about Scheherazade at the beginning. 1001 Night, Alf Layla wa Layla, as we call it in Arabic, wasn't looked at as a Arabic literary heritage. People thought it was vulgar. They thought it was very badly written. It is not literature, it's folk tales and nothing else. But then everything changed.
You mentioned the vulgarity. I mean, these tales are very sexually explicit.
They are.
Why are these stories so sexual? They would be compelling stories without it. What is essential about that component?
Yes, because they are down to earth. People at that time didn't think that, oh, this is forbidden or we shouldn't be talking about sexuality. They talked about all aspects of life, and one aspect is sexuality. And they left also their imagination to play a big part in thinking about sexuality, because you find jinns and demons and ghosts were all having affairs.
Jinns or genies.
Genies, yeah, you call them genies. And
everybody's having sex.
Yeah. Couldn't believe it when I was reading. I said, and it is so open. And because they didn't camouflage anything. This is what they thought. This is what they said. This is what they wrote.
What is the connection of these stories to Arab society now?
Well, I'd like every single Arab to read 1001 Nights. They learn a lot from them. Especially that these stories were written away from the influence of religion. And it's amazing to see how we were open, how we had a dialogue with each other, how we wanted to understand. We respected each other. There was a great dignity. And I'd like this to be restored again.
1001 Nights, as retold by Hanan el-Sheikh. Ms. Al-Sheikh, it has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for sports. Every once in a while, the intrepid Mike Pesca has to take one for the team. Go out into the field for a tough assignment. You know, watch some basketball, work on his tan. He is in Miami covering the NBA Finals. Hi, Mike.
I don't work on the tan. It just comes to me.
You know, it's no work. It's just easy.
It just the sun remembers my Mediterranean roots and bam, I'm dark.
Okay, so back to the task at hand. You are there covering the NBA Finals. The Miami Heat lost their first game to the San Antonio Spurs by 4 points. But this is like Miami's thing, right? I mean, they've done this before. They've lost their first game of the Finals.
Yeah, they've lost the first game of the Finals and came back last year and won every other game after that. In fact, since the LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh era began, so for the last 3 years, every time they've lost the first game, they've won every game after that in a series. And that certainly seems like a trend. The other big trend going on is every time in this playoffs that they've lost a game, they've come back and crushed their opponents.
So what 22. Gives?
Yeah, well, there are a couple ways to analyze this. One is, and the Heat players do acknowledge that this is a real thing, that energy is involved. But, you know, I would also kind of caution us in that we are cherry-picking statistics a little bit. They have had a five-game playoff series, and, you know, in three of them I talked about, the one game they lost was game one. But twice they lost a game four, and once they lost a game three. So is it really that stark? But the thing we come back to is what the players say. LeBron James says, you know, sometimes it takes a loss for us to get edge. And I was talking to Shane Batt. You see, so LeBron has to kind of be hesitant. He can't really admit to a lot of things that are obvious. Last 4,000 sports talk radio guys jumped down his throat. So I was talking to Shane Batt. He is a little more comfortable with the media. And, you know, he gave a couple good points of analysis. One is that after a loss, he says, the wax clears out of their ears. They're more receptive to the coaching, and the coaching is usually pretty good. And then he just flat out says, we play harder. One thing we could change is our energy and our effort, and we do. And after a loss, we flat out play harder. You know, it's not that we're not playing very, very hard, but we're up against other teams, and the energy sometimes does change. So there was that acknowledgement.
Do you think that the teams that they play kind of build that into their strategy?
Not at all. And this was asked to the, this is the thing that you asked to the Heat. I mean, when you have this statistic, this huge, weird statistic hanging out there, you have to ask everybody. And not only do the Spurs deflect that, like, what are you supposed to do if you think that that is true? What are you supposed to do if you think that some more energized Heat squad is coming your way? There's really nothing practically you can do. So you say a cliche, which happens to be very true and comforting, which is, you know, all we could do is we're going to play our games and try to execute the best we can. Kawhi Leonard, the guy who's primary responsibility was defending LeBron, was just about the worst interview ever yesterday when I was asking him questions. I mean, everyone was, but, you know, he was like, LeBron still got 18 points. You know, he still had a great game. You know, he's still a great player. I'm like, but 18 points is the fewest he's gotten in 2 years. Is that an accomplishment? Absolutely not. Our only accomplishment is winning. But you know what? So as a reporter, I'm like, give me something, Kawhi. If I were on the Spurs or a Spurs fan, that's exactly what you want. No, we've accomplished nothing.
Okay, second game is tonight. What should we look for? Who's going to win?
This is a good question. I cannot answer that. I think I'm bound not to answer that. I will say that if the Heat loses, they were calling this a must-win. Of course, they really want to win. You don't want to go to San Antonio and play 3 games down 2-0. If any team could do that, it's the Heat. But there'll be a couple days off between games, and everyone will be going crazy. There'll be a lot of pressure. You know, in feminist theory, they talk about the male gaze, G-A-Z-E. Mm. And I think in sports, we have the Heat gaze. Everything we do is through the prism of the Heat. So we all think it's up to the Heat to change. Some of this is that Tim Duncan is so steady. But the Spurs are a different team than those other teams that the Heat have come back and swept in those 5-game series. I mean, they're a great, great team.
Okay, real quick, curveball.
Yeah, was that the Haiti-Spain game, soccer game, Spain the best team in the world? The Haitians, and they went up 2-0 early, and they were not going to lose. But the Haitians scored a goal. They actually scored a goal with about 70 minutes into the game, and they all started chanting, Yo pa kwe say, yo pa, what is this, yo pa kwe say? It means, you cannot believe this. I thought that was a wonderful chant in a sports setting. The president of Haiti was there. They were all going crazy. The guy who scored the goal had the name of his mother and his son, who was born Friday, written on his
jersey. Oh, very nice. NPR's Mike Pesca. Thanks so much, Mike.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.